I know that every day, as the longer the time goes on, my life is in more and more danger. I know that. I'm aware of that. But the thing that was overwhelming, that fear that was eclipsing it, was my desire to find out what happened to my mother and get justice for her.
Hello, good people. Boy, do I have an episode for you, a really unique original story. It's Collier Landry, and I suppose this fits in the true crime section of the episodes that I do. You know, it's a big mix. I like to mix it up as much as I can. But this, it's not just true crime. I suppose it's just a really unique situation. And I guess that's why I started On the Edge with Andrew Gold as a podcast 2.5 years ago. I wanted to get inside the minds of people either living on the fringes, the edge is, of course, the edge is on the edge, or just people who've really lived unique experiences and unique lives that most of us will never live, and hopefully will never live, because a lot of these are extremely painful and tragic stories. And Collier Landry's is about as painful and tragic as it gets, because he heard his father murdering his mother. And that's pretty extraordinary. I can't imagine how many people have had such experiences, and it's just fascinating and sad and strange to listen to Collier. So please do go check out his podcast, where he talks more about this. He's gone on Dr. Phil. He's spoken with about all of this, and you know, he was 11 years old when this happened. I don't want to give away too much now, because you'll get into the story as he tells it. But do go check out after this if you want to hear more about what happened and what that does to a person, and the PTSD involved in growing up having witnessed such a thing. Check out Collier Landry's Moving Past Murder with Collier Landry. Do go check that out, and it's lots of episodes wherever you get your normal podcasts, all about, you know, PTSD and narcissism and having a strange psychopathic father visiting him in prison, all these kinds of things. So do go check that out. Coming up are some big episodes. I know I often say that, but come on. So Saturday's episode, which is behind the paywall, it's on patreon.com/AndrewGold. You can get it on Apple subscribers as well. It's Teddy Hose from the Moonies. So he grew up in the Moonies. He's not in the Moonies anymore, I should say. That's the Unification Church. It's one of the biggest and scariest cults around. So go sign up, patreon.com/AndrewGold for that one. And then in the week, there's Paul Bloom, who is one of the most famous and preeminent psychologists in the world. He was a professor at Yale. He's now at Toronto in Jordan Peterson's old office, and he's got a new book called Psych, and we talk all about what it means to be me and you, and what our brains are. And it's just a real back and forth, one of my favorites actually in a long while. And then there's all sorts of people. I'm doing lots of episodes in person, because whenever I can, I want to do that now, because it's a lot more fun and interesting and personal. And there's Alexander Barnes Ross talking about his time in England Scientology. There's loads of people actually. I don't want to spoil all the surprises, but some big guests coming up. But now you're on the edge with Collier Landry. I don't really know where to start here, because obviously what's happened to you is extremely traumatic, and usually I would sort of talk for a while and would get into bits and pieces and then go there, but then nothing would sort of make sense going forward to the audience who don't know the story. So I wondered if you wouldn't mind going in with what happened that night when you were 11 years old.
Sure. So on the night of December 31st, 1989, I awoke to a sound of two loud thuds. Well, initially, it was a scream that woke me up, and then I heard two loud thuds about 60 seconds apart. And I knew right then and there that something was happening to my mother, and it wasn't good. And then I counted about 12 footsteps as they walked down the hall, and as I was sleeping, or as I was laying in my bed, I pretended to be asleep, and I was looking at the clock, and I could see out of my peripheral vision two feet in the doorway. And something just told me, don't look up. And the footsteps went, the feet went away, and I finally fell back asleep. I don't know how I did that. This was about 3:15, 3:30 in the morning. Like 3:18 is the time that I remember waking up, because I had a Batman clock on the wall. It's actually over my shoulder right now. And I remember just thinking, okay, it's obviously happened to my mother, because it was in her bedroom where I could hear this, which is about, like I said, a good 12 feet away, right? And the next morning when I woke up, I ran straight to her bedroom. And I said, I started rummaging through her sheets, and I was as I noticed, the bed was sort of in disarray. Like, my mother, the first thing she would do when she would get up in the morning, as I do and as I still do to this day, is make the bed. So the sheets were in a disarray. There were sheets that were missing, and I'm looking for blood on those actual sheets. I go downstairs. I don't find anything. I go downstairs, and my father is sitting on the couch, and he's got a towel wrapped around his waist. He had just gotten out of the shower, apparently. And I said to him, I said, "Where is my mother?" And he didn't say anything. He was watching television. He didn't say anything. And I said again, "Where is my mother?" And he looked at me and he goes, "Well, mommy took a little vacation, Collier." And at that moment, I knew that he killed her, or that he's done something to her. And he starts going into this whole spiel on how we're not going to contact the police, we're not going to contact the FBI. And I thought that was really weird. Like, you know, I grew up in a very small town in Ohio. The FBI is not the first people that they're not first responders, right? And I just thought to myself, okay, his behavior is very strange. And he starts saying, okay, we're not going to call anyone. We're not going to alert anyone. She'll come back. And I'm thinking to myself, no, dude. And my grandmother had come to stay with us the night before. She was his mother. The ironic thing is, she was extremely close to my mother. And like, her and my mother were almost like mother and daughter, or even like sisters. Like, they dressed a lot alike. They both had this sort of flair for style and fashion and art and things like that, because my grandmother didn't have a very particularly close relationship with her own daughter, and my mother didn't have a particularly close relationship with her mother. So they had been friends for, you know, decades, right? And my father leaves, and my grandmother says to me, okay, listen to your father. We're not going to call anyone. We're not going to do anything like that. And I remember just, she went into the kitchen. And what had happened is, a few months before that, my mother had bought a cordless phone. So this will tell you, this is 1989, right? So this is 1989, December 1989. And I grab the cordless phone and I run upstairs, and I had saved all of my mother's friends' phone numbers on a piece of paper, and I'd hidden them in a Garfield that I had, because my parents had been getting a divorce and my father's behavior was becoming more and more peculiar and more aggressive. And look, my father was very abusive to both of us growing up. And my mother, the divorce was getting really nasty, and he had a girlfriend, you know, that I had met, and that's what kind of caused all of this, and we can get into that a little later. But so I was prepared, because my mother had said something to me about a month and a half before that. She told me, it was right around like Thanksgiving-ish, mid-November to Thanksgiving. And she said, "Collier, I want you to know that if anything ever happens to me, that your father probably had me killed."
Wow, what a thing to say to her son.
Yeah, an 11-year-old, right? And I just remember thinking, okay. I remember saying to my mother, "Well, no, Daddy wouldn't do that." And but she's like, "No, I would never leave you. You know, your father has mafia ties." You know, and she was, at this time, like, she had officially filed for divorce from my father, but she had also, you know, she was getting really, you know, buggered in the divorce. She was just, you know, my father was a doctor. she had run his books, but, you know, my father was saying things to me like, you know, at the time I had gone to private school, and he said, I'm going to make it so you have to go to public school with all the other poor kids, which I didn't know the difference between public and private school. I just knew I went to school, right? And I'm going to make sure your mommy is working at McDonald's by the time I'm through with her, and you guys are going to have nothing. You're going to be left with nothing. And the thing was, is this like this violent and aggressive behavior towards both of us, you know, had sort of culminated towards the end of that year. And, you know, my father had a girlfriend. He was moving on. He was moving on to a new life, and was telling me like how he's going to move on, have this fabulous life, and I'm going to be left with nothing. And I was aware that my father was a scumbag, and I had grown up in a lot of fear of my father because he had one of those violent tempers. He was very apoplectic and, you know, a rageaholic, and I was in fear of him, and especially because of what my mother said to me. So I'd hidden these phone numbers. I take the cordless phone, I go into the bathroom, and I lock the door, and I start calling every single one of my mother's friends, and I tell them what happened. I said, I need you to call the police because I told my father I wouldn't call the police. So I won't be disobeying. You guys call the police for me. So what had happened then is a few hours later, two uniformed officers come in a black and white to our house. And my grandmother is livid. And she's yelling at me, and I'm like, I didn't do anything, right? Because I didn't call the police, technically. And the police start doing a walkthrough of the house, and they're asking me questions, and my grandmother's hovering right behind me, yelling at them and telling them, there's nothing to see here, blah, blah, blah. And I really couldn't get any alone time with them. But I do remember saying to one of the officers, which is something that my mother always said about my father. She said, I don't trust your father as far as I could throw him. So I said that to one of the officers. I said, I don't trust my father as far as I could throw him. So later on that day, you know, I don't hear anything. And this is, you know, New Year's Eve. So the following day, I call my mother's friends and I'm like, okay, what's going on? Like, what's happening? And they said, you know, okay, we filed a missing persons report. And I'm like, it's not just a missing person, you know? And I mean, I know that something has happened to her. We don't know where she's at, but like she's in danger, right? And I think she's dead. And a detective happens to show up at the house, and his name is Lieutenant David Messmore. And my grandmother again is like yelling at him and about my son, this, that, my son's a doctor, blah, blah, blah. And so I have this thing where my mother had always told me, sort of relating to the old carousels in like the 50s and 40s or whatever, you go around the carousel and you try to grab the brass ring. And you win a prize, right? So my mother always told me, like, you want to grab the brass ring in life. You want to seize that opportunity. So one of the things that, like, when I tell this story, I just think about, like, how my mother prepared me for what was to come without even really knowing it, right? And, you know, as I get older, like, I think about all of this because people ask me, like, how did you cope with this? How did you deal with this? How are you so resilient? And, you know, obviously kids are very resilient to begin with, but I was very much in this action state once my mother went missing. So what happens is David Messmore is at the door. My grandmother's yelling at him, of course, but he charms his way in the house and I'm like, come on in. And my grandmother, you know, again, this brass ring moment that I talk about, my grandmother goes and leaves the room and she says, I'm going to call my son. He's a doctor, blah, blah. So she goes to grab the phone because now I've been busted with the cordless phone already. so that's done. So she goes to grab the phone and I look at Dave and I say, my mother isn't missing. Like something has happened to her. She would never leave me. I say, give me your card. He gives me his card. I put it in my pocket. My grandmother comes in. She's yelling at him. He kind of does a little walk around. He talks to her. He talks to me in front of her. And that's, you know, that's it. And he just, and he leaves and goes, okay, I'm going to come back for the doctor, like my father, right? So I go to school. Well, actually, later on that night, my father's girlfriend shows up. This is New Year's Day, 1990, New Year's Day. And his girlfriend shows up and she's got pot, or like a pork roast for us, which is like a traditional thing and for New Year's with sauerkraut. And it's terrible. And like, we're playing house. It's just the weirdest thing ever. Like, I barely know this woman. She's disgusting to me to begin with. And here she is in my house pretending to be my mother. And I'm just like, this is ridiculous. So the next day I go to school. And the first thing I do is I go straight to the principal's office. I give them Lieutenant Messmore's business card. I said, I need you to call this guy. I want to talk to him, get him down here. So Lieutenant Messmore comes down to my school and I spend hours outlining the whole of my parents' relationship, everything about my father's mistress that I know, everything about my father's proclivity for violence, the way he's treated me and my mother over the years, everything, every single detail of my life, I'm telling this guy. And I'm reiterating the fact that like my mother would never leave me. Something has happened to her. I believe she's dead. She told me this a couple of months ago. This is what I heard, you know, everything. And I say to him, I'm going to go home. And while my grandmother is dealing with my younger sister, because my mother and father had adopted a little girl from Taiwan, like about 6-7 months before all this occurred. And I said, while my grandmother is dealing with my sister and making dinner, I'm going to run upstairs and I'm going to pull out the bookshelves where there's a crawl space up in our attic. And I'm going to look for my mother's body. I'm then going to start looking for my mother's purse, because my mother would never leave her this one purse that she always had at the house. She would have left with something, because my father, in his detail to me on the morning of December 31st, he said that my mother came down, they got into a fight in the living room, she was screaming at him, she threw credit cards at him and her purse, and then literally left the living room and left the house and walked down our driveway in the dead of winter with no coat, no nothing, and got into a car that was waiting at the end of the driveway for her. And my father was at that time speculating who this was, and oh, it's her best friend, Shelley Bowden, and all these people, and this is what happened. And it was all bullshit. I knew he was lying. And so I share all this information with Dave. So when I go home, I start looking for all these clues. And of course, I don't find my mother's body. And I go to school the next day. I call him up. I tell him what I'm looking for. And so over the course of the next 25 days, this whole thing starts to unravel. So my father is gone, obviously, during the day at work, but he's also traveling up to Erie, Pennsylvania, which is where he is going to start this new medical practice that he's going into business with his girlfriend's uncle. And they're going to start this like private occupational medicine practice, right? For like workman's comp here in the States. And what I begin to sort of realize is my father's behavior has really changed. And he goes from being this very violent and angry and aggressive person to sort of having a little bit of a passive behavior. And one of the things that threw me off the first time is I had just gotten a Nintendo for Christmas that year. And I'm playing this video game and it's a punching game. It's called Double Dragon, like a fighting game. And he sees it and he goes, oh my God, I never would have bought that for you if I had known that it was a violent fighting game. And I'm thinking to myself, you're the guy that would scream at me when I would, and call me a pussy and a little faggot and all these derogatory terms. If I covered my eyes and didn't want to watch something violent on television, like he would watch Commando or something and it would scare me. So I'd be like, I don't want to see people die. He'd be like, you're a pussy. Because my father over the years would claim that he was like a Vietnam War hero and all this stuff. This is what war is like. And all this just like crazy, toxic, you know, not to use the word of the day, but toxic masculinity. But this is truly toxic masculinity in treating your son this way. And, you know, and of course it was all bullshit too. Like he lied about all this as he made up all these accolades. But, and so I'm like, what, like, this is really bizarre. And I remember, and of course, when I'm going to school every single day, I am literally calling the Mansfield Police Department to speak to Lieutenant Messmore to tell him this is what happened. And this is my new evidence. This is what's going on. And I remember my father came home one time and he asked me to rub Bengay, which is like an icy hot like ointment on his shoulders for sore muscles, because he said he was moving boxes and he was really sore from that. And I thought, okay, he's never asked me to do this. This is super weird. And I look down and I see these cuts on his hand, all over his hands. And my father had really very well manicured hands. In fact, he was very proud of that. And he had all these scars and scratches and things on his hands. And I thought, okay, that's odd. And so I'm telling all this to Lieutenant Messmore. What ends up happening is about midway through January 1990. My father is home early and he comes to me and he says, "Hey, I need to go to my office to go get paperwork. Will you come with me?" And I'm, or come with me. Not will you, come with me. And I had noticed that my father's behavior again was also becoming very passive, but also every night, almost every night, he's at home with his divorce lawyer and they're meeting in our family dining room, and the police are coming to the door. Dave Messmore, who I'm talking to behind his back at school, is coming to my door of the house, and I see him and we have this like we don't know each other type thing. Like we're both in on it, but we don't know each other type thing. I'm like, I don't know who this is. And I notice that my father is becoming a little more stressed every day. Like there's something weighing on him. And of course, I'm telling this to Dave Messmore. What happens is my father takes me to this, it takes me to his work. And on the way back home, we stop at a gas station to get gas. And my father goes into the gas station. And I can see him, obviously, through the windshield, and I'm watching him like a hawk. And I'm like, okay, this is another brass ring moment. I start rummaging through his truck and looking for clues. And I open up his center console, and I find two photographs, two Polaroids. One is of a house that I've never seen before. And the second is of his girlfriend with her two children, who I've met, sitting in front of a fireplace that's wrapped in plastic. And right then I was like, this is a new house. Like this, I've never seen this before. This is clearly a new house, like that maybe they're moving into or whatever. So I go next day to school. So this is like January 15th, 16th, 1990. I go the next day to school and I tell Dave Messmore about this house, this photographs I find. And I don't hear from him for a couple of days. And, you know, I'm just kind of checking in like, okay, are there any leads? Oh, we're working on it. So then my father says to me, this is around like January 21st, 1990. My father says to me again, every night, police keep coming to the house to want to talk to him, to interview him and his lawyers. And there's now things posted outside the house. We're not speaking to anyone. All this, his lawyers advising me, don't be talking to the cops. Don't do this. But nobody seems to really realize that like I'm literally cooperating with the police, reporting my father's every move to the cops at school every single day. I am watching him like a hawk everywhere.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on what could go right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
How do you feel in this moment? I mean, because obviously, I mean, it's been decades now, and I can imagine there's some part of you, I might be wrong about this, but that feels a little bit desensitized from just telling the story. And what I'm interested in here is trying to get to, you're 11 years old, and you are very certain from what you're saying that your mum is dead, that your mum is dead. That must have, I mean, and then you'll go, I mean, how did you even go to school? And then you have to, like, report your father. So where were you with the emotions on this? How was everything in your head?
Well, I mean, my mission first of all, I loved going to school. I just education was highly valued in my family. But I was going to school because that was the only place where I could talk about any of this. It was my safe place. And when I look back on it, you know, and yes, you're right. I probably am a bit ties to it because I've told this story for so long. I've been living with this for over 30 years now. And, you know, after starting my podcast a year ago, I still am very much like getting more and more public with my story, right? And sharing my story with people. So for me, maybe I'm becoming desensitized to it, but right now in this moment as a child, all I'm doing is thinking this situation at school is an opportunity for me to catch this motherfucker.
But is there not also like panic? Like, you know, what about mom? Because didn't you want to be proven wrong? Or were you that sure?
I mean, well, we'll get to that. But yes, of course. And I think this is the thing that's interesting for me when I think about this, and it's a good question. It's a good question what you're posing. I think there is a very fine line between, and I'm sure investigators go through this, right? Between your logical brain of like, this is really what's happening, and your sort of creative, your brain where you say, I want to believe it's something else. I want to defy this logic and believe that she's staying with a friend, or she's just hiding out, or she's on vacation somewhere and just needed me time. There's all these things that go through your head, right? And this continues, by the way. It's even after its supposed finality, right? And I think that a lot of people in traumatic situations, but for me, the way that I was is I was very, and this is what I talk about when I talk about trauma and relating to trauma. And I do this like on my podcast, I do this when I coach people, I've done a TED talk about this, is that for me, overcoming the trauma was very much about action. It's not about like why this is happening. It's about what I'm going to do now with this, like what's next. And so for me, having that action and using my skill set, my sort of amateur sleuthing, or just my unwavering desire to find out what was wrong. Because you have to understand, I'm afraid of my father. And I think my father just killed my mother. So I'm really afraid of him, and I'm afraid for my life, right? I know that as the longer the time goes on, my life is in more and more danger. I know that. I'm aware of that. And that's really hard to for a lot of people to sort of reconcile. But the thing that was overwhelming that fear, that was eclipsing it, was my desire to find out what happened to my mother and get justice for her. And even though I thought that she was, that something had happened to her, that she was murdered, I still was holding out hope that there was a happy ending to this. And I also was like, this doesn't matter. My safety doesn't matter. I need to be smart about this. I can't be overt with my father. I need to be covert as fuck. I need to be flying under the radar as much as possible and play dumb with my father about the police and all these things. But ultimately, like, it just became my mission. Like, every second of every day was at home watching him, looking for clues, at school, talking about it, getting to working with police. Every day that I find something, I'm searching for this, that, and the other. So what happens is around, and again, as I was saying, you know, I'm observing all of my father's behavior, and he's becoming more, a little more and more anxious, and like something's wrong. And clearly I'm thinking to myself, as the police keep showing up, Detective Messmore showing up every night, I'm here to talk to the doctor. You know, the pressure is on, the squeeze is on, and maybe the fix is in for him. And I think that he's kind of realizing that. And he says to me, he goes, you know, Collier, so this is around the 21st or 22nd of January, 1990. He says to me, he goes, you know, I know this has been really hard on, and he keeps talking about every night, we're always talking and speculating on where my mother could have gone. He's like, I wonder where mommy is. I wonder what she's doing right now. I hope she had a good dinner. I hope she had, she was, and he's like reminiscing or romanticizing all this. It's just very strange. And he says to me, he goes, I know this has been really hard on mommy leaving us all, and it's been hardest on you, Collier. So I have an idea. I have a medical conference that's happening in Florida, and I think we should do a father and son trip. Now, every year, my family would go on a trip to Clearwater Beach, Florida, for a medical conference. And it was always in the spring.
Scientology base.
Yeah. Which I know has no parallel to this. But we would go to Clearwater Beach, Florida, where they have it. And it was always in the spring. So it was timed around like spring break for kids here in the States, right? That way family can go on vacation. There's the Busch Gardens there. There's the beaches. So it's a family vacation thing. And there's also this medical conference. So I knew when my father is saying, there's a medical conference in Florida that I want to take you to. I knew it was bullshit because this is January 21st. It's the middle of winter. We just got back from Christmas break. I knew that that's not possible. I knew that he was lying. And I realized at that moment when he's telling me about this trip and then he wants it to be a father and son bonding trip and to really help me get over my mother just leaving the family the way she did and all that, I knew at that moment that I was not coming back from Florida. And I was like, this motherfucker's going to kill me. I'm going to drown in the Gulf of Mexico. So I go to school the next day. I call Dave Messmore immediately and I tell him what's up. And I said, I learned how to swim when I was 4 years old. I'm going to drown in the Gulf of Mexico. There's going to be some freak accident. I'm not coming back from Florida. You can't let me go with this guy. And on the morning of January 24th, 1990, I woke up to two people from Children's Services, Child Protective Services, in my room at like 6 a.m. And they said, pack a bag. You got 20 minutes to get out of here. And I said to them, can I take my dog? And they said, we'll come back for your dog. Never saw my dog again. Packed up stuff for myself and my sister. Because they had said, I'm going to go, I'm just going to go stay the day at somebody's house. I could hear all this commotion going on downstairs. And as we come down the stairs, the entire house is full of investigators, men and women in white lab coats carrying devices. It's a full-on like CSI crime scene thing. My grandmother's screaming. They're serving search warrants, all these things. She's on the phone trying to get a hold of my father. It's a mess. And they take me from the house. And I go to stay at a friend's house, principal of my school, temporarily. And I have a social worker that arrives a little later on that afternoon. And she's like, oh, my name is Karen Jordan. I'm a social worker, and blah, blah, blah. I'm your caseworker. I'm your caseworker. I thought to myself, I don't really know what a caseworker is, but I am intelligent enough to know that that's not good. You don't just get a caseworker. And she basically starts alluding to me that, you know, police are looking for your father. And, you know, I'm like, and I knew all this was going to come to a head. I just wasn't sure when that was going to be. But it was all coming to a head. And I realized, you know, I mean, I knew on the morning of December 31st, 1989, I knew when I woke up and to that scream, I knew when I heard the thuds, I knew that my life was never going to be the same.
Do you remember how that felt in that moment?
Yeah, you feel alone. You feel like you're so unsure of all of this. Like, what does life look like now? Because I know that, because there's a couple of things that are going through my head. One is that, okay, this is now serious. This has gone from me talking to a police officer to them actually doing something about it. Like, there's a police presence in my house. The shit's hitting the fan. Like, I knew that. And at the same time, I'm like, okay, I guess I'm going to find out what happened to my mother. But I'm also like, what happens? You know, a big part of this that a lot of people don't understand is that if this turns out a different way, let's say my father isn't arrested. I have to go back and live with this man after talking to police behind his back. After essentially leading an investigation against my father. And that is something that nobody ever thinks about, is that there's consequences. The whole time that I'm talking to the police, the whole time that every day I'm going to school, I am aware, very keenly aware, that there are severe consequences to what I'm doing as far as like reprimand from my father. And this is somebody who I grew up being afraid of. So that was something that I think a lot of people don't get, because they're just like, oh, you're talking to police and everything. It's like, you're not safe. I'm not safe. There is nothing stopping him from killing me the whole time. If I was going to Florida, I would not have come back, because he started putting two and two. My father's not a stupid man. He went to his college. He was a doctor. Went to Penn. He's a college educated individual. He might be a psychopath, but he's an educated individual. He's so intelligent. He was figuring it out, because the police keep coming. Like, they keep getting new evidence. They're now looking at things that how do they know about all this stuff? Oh, my son's telling. So obviously, my son is talking to someone. So there is. Oh, I just thought about just my father drowning me for a second. In those moments, like, you just kind of got to go with like, what's the lesser of two evils? Like, it's like, do I do what's right? Do I try to find my mother? Do I find justice for her? Or do I play along for my own safety? And I was never at any point did it ever occur to me to play along for my own safety, other than like, it buys me time, like, to appease my father, to entertain his wild theories about where she could have went. I mean, that I did do with him. I was like, oh, maybe she went shopping in Toronto, but I didn't believe him. You know, I didn't believe what I was saying, but I was doing it just to buy time. But no, yeah, I was scared for my life every single day. I knew that once I left school, like, anything could happen to me. And and if this man had definitely had done something to my mother, what's to stop him from doing something to me? Nothing. It's not even that night when I hear the footsteps come down the hall and they stop in my doorway. If I look up and let's say there's blood on my father's hands or my father's enraged because he's just killed my mother. It's nothing for him to make the hole a little bigger and say she left with the kid. Oh, I don't know where she went. She left with the kid. We got into a fight. They're gone. I don't know. She took her son.
Was there closure upon, you know, the, hearing that she had in fact died and that, that you were right? Was there closure with that?
Well, so I'll get to that. So I end up staying with that family friend that night. And that night I end up having the worst asthma attack of my life. And because I had just left my house so abruptly, I didn't have any of my asthma stuff. And I had really bad asthma as a kid. So I get really, really sick and I think I'm going to die. And I go the next morning, I somehow survive through the night. I don't know how, because I'm literally fighting for every breath. And I go to the hospital the next morning and to see a family friend who was a doctor, who's a cardiologist. And I remember going into the hospital and the whole lobby of the hospital was full of people. And, you know, this is 1990, so we still had newspapers back then in honor boxes where you put the money in, and you take the newspapers and you just take one newspaper, but they're all in there. They're called honor boxes. And I get ushered past the honor box and I go into this room and I get a breathing treatment and they sort of stabilize me and I can breathe. And that's when they tell me, call your Lieutenant Messmer found your mother. And then there's like this eternal pause. And they say, and she was dead. And you talk about that sort of cognitive dissonance between you are holding out hope that this has a happy ending, but the other part of you is like he killed her. And this has been the thing that I've been fighting in my mind for 26 days at this point now, since she disappeared December 31st. And I don't know how to really describe it. It's a very surreal feeling because part of you is relieved that you were right. So you have that confirmation that you weren't crazy. You weren't making all of this up. You didn't dream this. And then part of you wishes this was a dream and this wasn't happening. And then there's this other part of you that is so overwhelmed and overcome with sadness. Because the person that you loved the most in the world, that you were the closest to, that was, you were their constant companion for your entire life, is gone. They're not coming back. And I remember the first thing that I said was, that bastard. And again, you know, I had said earlier, going out of the house, you know, the crime lab is there, all of this stuff, there's search warrants, that I knew that it was sort of like a crossing of the Rubicon, if you will. Like there's no going back, like my life has changed. Less than 24 hours later, there's another crossing of the Rubicon. Like now it's official. And I come out and I had seen the honor box that I was ushered past. And there's my father on the front cover. And it says, Boyle arrested for wife's murder. And it's my father in handcuffs being led out of our house. And it's a really surreal feeling. Because you don't, there's so much uncertainty. Again, there's this relief like, okay, I'm not crazy. But then it's like, what is life now? How does that work? Like, what am I going to do right now? Like, how am I going to survive? Where am I going to go? Where am I going to live? And I had, as traumatizing as those previous 26 days were, and as traumatizing it is knowing that your father has been arrested for murdering your mother, and you're just now convinced, you know, because it wasn't like there's speculation, she disappeared and there was no evidence. Like, I heard it happen. I know what happened. So for me, he's not a suspect. He's guilty, because you just found a body in his house that he bought, that I found the photographs of, and I heard it happen. So for me, it's like, it's done deal. Okay, great. There's no guilty until proven innocent, or innocent until proven guilty in my mind. There's no Lady Justice holding scales. It's like, you did this. How's he going? What's happening now? Because so it's not like in my mind where I go, okay, well, there'll be a trial. There'll be evidence. There will be like all these things will come out and we'll see what happens. The only thing that's in my mind is he going to prison, or is he going to the electric chair, or is he going to get off? Those are the three choices in my mind that it's happening. Because I know what happened. And I think when I think about a lot of, you know, I talk a lot about on my podcast, Moving Past Murder, about ethical true crime or true crime in general, and people speculating and media conjecture or social media conjecture surrounding true crime cases or cases that are actively, and there's a lot of obviously right now the cases of the moment are the Anna Walsh case, and there's the Cohasset, the Idaho 4 killings with Brian Koberger, and then there's this, you know, Murdaugh trial going on right now in the United States. So there's all these things happening, and there's all this speculation that comes out regarding these cases, the Delphi murders, all these things, and all of those cases are all based, like, there's no witnesses. There's no, like, I saw them do this. This happened here. I was this. I was the witness. I heard it happen. I observed the behavior. I know what transpired in my house. I found the evidence. And that house that I found the photograph of is where they dug her body up underneath the basement floor. And for me, it became in that moment, and I'm literally just thinking about this now. I've never even really thought about this. I am literally thinking that for me, in that moment, there was a finality to it. I don't have to wait to find my answers. In other murder cases, there's a trial. They're trying to figure out all this. And people have to go through this process of, okay, is this person that we have as a suspect, are they guilty? Are they not guilty? When are we going to get our answers? For me, I had those answers. So in a very interesting way, and again, I'm just thinking of this now, I was able to process immediately. Whereas some people have to wait months, years for answers. I was able to literally go right now, okay, he killed her. He is guilty. Now what are we doing? What's going on? And I testified against my father at the grand jury because they had to secure an indictment. So within the next couple of days, I testified. So this is January 25th. He's arrested, 1990. January 27th, I think I'm testifying at the grand jury to secure his indictment for my mother's murder. And then what ensues is just, it's something that I can't even fathom, because what happened was, is my mother's sister came, and obviously to like identify the body or whatever, but my mother's sister came and we had like a memorial service for my mother, which was super weird. And for a lot of different reasons, people speaking up, because of course this happens in a small town. So now everybody wants to be a part of it, because it's like a television show or a soap opera. Whereas I'm like, what am I going to do now? Like, he's going to go on trial. I'm going to testify against him, and this is all going to go down. But what happens is that instead of being embraced by my family, I am rejected by them. My mother's sister says to me, "We cannot take you in because you look like your father." Dead serious. Dead ass. And I remember having that conversation. My father's side of the family is angry with me, and they, over the years, have been so manipulated by my father, and they're in shock of themselves too. And I think that, you know, my mother was extremely close to my father's younger brother. They were like best friends. So she's close to my grandmother, his mother, and she's really close with his younger brother, the youngest sibling of his three. And I think, and he's my godfather. So my aunt Carol, who's my mother's sister, is my godmother, and he's my godfather. But there's just so much going on, maybe I'm giving them an out. I mean, I am. I always have given them an out with my family, but I understand at this point as an adult of the hold that someone who is a narcissist or a psychopath has on families. And I know that there was a big element of like, well, I think a lot of ways they blame me for bringing it all on because I'm the one, because it's all found out that I'm the one that's like, they have no case without the kid giving them all this evidence. And it was all because I was determined to outsmart my father and I wasn't going to let him get away with this. I mean, if you think about the amount of time that passes between December 31st and January 25th, what can happen in that amount of time? And there's so much that can go on. Bodies can be disposed of, things can move on, and you don't know a damn thing. And this isn't like, this is 1990, this isn't 2023, where there's a trail of evidence and internet searches and all these things that, you know, there's no internet at this point. So it's all based on speculation and hearsay and good old fashioned police work, right? And a kid gathering evidence against his father. And when you think about all of those things compared to how today is, the justice that was served immediately with him being indicted and he was arrested. And then all of that coming down on my family, like they were coping with this and they took it out on me. So I was remanded to the foster care system with total strangers.
How did that go?
It was not good. Living in foster care is never a fun thing and you're treated like an outsider. And it's not good. And the foster parents who were fostering me, they wanted custody of my sister because they wanted to adopt a little girl from China. So my mother was helping them with that. But that's why they took us in. But I was just kind of cast aside. And I won't get into some of the specifics of that, but like it wasn't a good situation. Let's just put it that way. And I had it good. When I hear about other kids that go into foster care, like I had it good compared to that. And you have a lot of this, like I'm the son of a murderer too, right? So essentially living in foster care and being this key witness against my father, like I can't watch the news, I can't watch TV because it's all over the news, all over the television. I can't read the newspaper. I can't do anything normal. I can't really have any normal engagements really with that aren't supervised. It's like my whole world is turned upside down. And in those moments leading up to the trial, right? So there's months. So my father's trial began in June of 1990. And I had to, without really any support system, you know, I had bonded with Dave Messmore and his wife and you know, because Dave was there and he believed me as far as the detective. And he came to talk to me after to tell me about my mother, like finding my mother, because he wanted to sit down with me and give me that resolution. You know, he wanted to say, this is what happened. And I was just like, really, he still to this day will say, I was just so impressed with just how you handled it. You were just so, you were really sad. You were overcome with sadness, but you were accepting of it. And again, as I said earlier, a lot of these things are, unbeknownst to me, were set up by my mother and the way she raised me, the way she treated me. I was treated like a little adult. And, you know, and I had to be the adult in the situation, because here's my family saying to me, we don't want anything to do with you. And so basically I had to go through all of this alone. And the thing is, also, as I had said before, with my father, there's a chance that my father could get exonerated. Like, this goes to trial. He's pleading not guilty. He's got a high-powered legal team. What if he gets off? Well, my life is over. What do you think? My father's going to forget about it? I'm going to go back to his custody. He's going to be like, hey, remember that time you tried to get me put in prison for murdering your mother?
I'm really interested in how it felt going back to see your father in prison and confronting him. I'm aware you did that as part of a film, or was it with Dr. Yeah. Phil? Was it?
No, it was. I made a movie. So flash forward. So all this happens. My father gets convicted. I grow up. I'm finally adopted by another family, and I am determined my entire life to do something good with this. So I grew up in this small town where everyone knows me. Everyone, you know, I stayed in Mansfield where all this happened. I grow up and I'm living in the shadow of all of this. And I said, I become really obsessed with the fact that we never look at the consequences of violence. We never examine what happens to, like, the victims and the families and the ancillary victims, the friends, the communities. So I sort of become obsessed with this, but also I become obsessed with the fact that I want to go somewhere where no one knows who I am, so I can figure out a way to tell this story on my own terms, and that I can, I will know that people appreciate and love and care and want to know me for me, not for some heinous act. So I go to music school for a couple of years. I drop out. I moved to Los Angeles. And I said to myself, I'm either going to become a rock star, become famous, tell my story and help people, or I'm going to become a filmmaker, tell my story, make a movie, tell my story and help people. And for me, I ended up becoming a filmmaker, a cinematographer. And I spent better part of two decades learning everything about the entertainment industry, learning how to shoot. I knew nothing. I knew nobody when I came out here. I came out with $2,000 in my pocket and just like, I don't know anybody, but I'll figure it out. And I learned all of these things. And I ended up meeting Barbara Kopple, two-time documentary filmmaker, two-time Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, rather, who is so well-respected. And she said, I really love your story. Let's tell it. And I created A Murder in Mansfield. And in the film, I maintained a relationship for decades with my father for the whole purpose of being able to tell this story. And I sit down with my father in prison. And the whole reason I did all of this was because I wanted to find out why he murdered my mother. And so everything I had done had led up to this. My entire life, everything, moving to LA, learning this because I wanted to find the answers. And I sit down with my father and I confront him. And as a lot of people have seen and will see, and is that I don't necessarily get that. And what I realize is, and I, like I said, I did a TED talk about this. What if the answer you seek is not the answer you need? And I realize in that moment that my father is a psychopath, and that the closure that I felt that I needed my entire life for me to move on, because mind you, like, I'm in my well into my 30s at this point, and I am really trying to get this resolution, because I had this relationship with my father over the decades. You know, I have 400 letters that my father has written me over the years in prison that I read on my podcast to show gaslighting and narcissism and psychopathy, manipulation, things like that. You know, my father, you know, I maintained this relationship, but it was rather sort of solipsistic in a lot of ways with him, because I never confronted him. And when the camera is rolling, it's the first time I've ever confronted him. And like I said, I learned in that moment that the thing that was eluding me my whole life, like, why did you do this? That drove me to become the person that I am sitting here having this interview with right now was all to find out that answer. And I realized that that's not really what I needed to move on. What I needed was to go through it. Well, what I needed to do is I needed to go through that journey, because there is no answer. And there's no answer that will ever be acceptable. My father could have sat and there and given me an answer that he felt was acceptable and admitted to killing her and admitted all this, and it still wouldn't be good enough. I probably have more questions, because in that moment, I realized finally for the first time in my life, I'm not this man. I'm not him, because that had been haunting me my whole life. Am I capable of doing such things? Because a lot of people think when they find out my story, that was something that haunted me. Parents, you're dating that guy. You never know. Watch out. There's things like that that are natural human reactions to these things. And I just, for me, I finally had that, it's not closure, but I had that finality where I was like, okay, I can take that. I mean, there's a picture over my shoulder right now, and it's of me sitting there with my father holding a letter, confronting him in prison. I remember coming home from filming in Ohio, came back to my place in Los Angeles. I printed out that photo, which was a screenshot of the film that we had shot, just the dailies. I put it in a frame and hung it on my wall, and I said, did that. Now I can move on with my life. 30 some years later, 26, 27 years later.
I'm happy you're able to move on with your life, Collier, and I would recommend that people please do go and support my guest by checking out Moving Past Murder with Collier Landry, and you get into all the details a lot, isn't it? It's a great podcast, isn't it, Collier?
And the podcast is about literally my process of healing. I interview people who have also been through similar circumstances, but it's about going through this and finding a way to move past it and do something positive with your life. That's my real story, is that I went through this horrific experience, but I figured out a way to do something positive and help others and heal myself at the same time. And it's still a process. I still discover things about my mother's murder. I read, I discover tapes of interviews my father gave. I open up letters that I haven't read before on the podcast. And it's just been this amazing journey that I continue going on, because healing from this is a process that takes a lifetime. And you just put one foot in front of the other. You carry water and you chop wood.
Thank you, Collier Landry, for that fascinating insight into a life on the edge, I suppose, letting us into his trauma and his experiences, telling us how the story unfolded. I hope you guys got something from that and saw or witnessed another side of life. If you enjoyed it, why not check out Moving Past Murder with Collier Landry? That's his podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, where he really goes into the nitty gritty and all the different interesting aspects of the murder of his mother by his father. Big episodes are coming up this Saturday. Do sign up to patreon.com/AndrewGold for my episode with Teddy Hose, who was in the Moonies cult, and he'll talk about why they are so dangerous. And then Monday is Professor Paul Bloom, formerly of Yale, now in Jordan Peterson's old office in Toronto. Very different kinds of psychologists, though. And that one I loved. We have a real back and forth and a friendship, I might say. A friendship with Professor Paul Bloom. So enjoy that, and I'll see you soon.